Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and culture stories. I'm Sammy Yenigan. This week on Culturetopia, the pop singer Adele has broken all kinds of records this year, but now she's broken her voice. A vocal cord operation has the singer sidelined for the rest of 2011. NPR's Elizabeth Blair tells us why it's not unusual for singers to need surgery. Then, an unconventional rude story from hip-hop's newest star, J. Cole. Born in Germany, Cole grew up in a trailer park and went on to graduate magna cum laude at St. John's. His debut album, Cole World, opened at the top of the Billboard charts. And finally, NPR's Margot Adler looks at Art of the Arab Lands, the recently reopened Islamic galleries at New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art. But first...
For the first time in 8 years, the Islamic galleries at the Metropolitan Museum of Art are open. The newly renovated galleries span 15 rooms, containing 1,200 objects from a rotating collection of thousands. The objects range from bits of handwriting to a Moroccan courtyard with a fountain, NPR's Margot Adler reports.
Some of the things in this overwhelming installation you might expect. Many others are surprising, at least to a layman. There is as much secular art here as religious. The written word, as you might expect, is central, and there are extraordinary examples of calligraphy and painting and pottery. Navina Haider is one of the curators of the Islamic department. Writing, she says,
it's sort of the quintessential and highest form of artistic expression in the Islamic world, and also the most binding thread, in one sense, artistically, between all the diverse places and cultures and types of media that you see.
There's a page from what may be the world's largest Quran, as tall as an adult. But in a room that many people enter first, filled with masterpieces from the collection, there's a 10th century bowl from Iran, white glaze with black letters, so pure and simple and yet abstract, it could be a piece of modern art. And here's a surprise. Images are everywhere. Animals, dragons, flowers, realistic paintings of people, a painting of a bat with one wing folded, even architectural images on a prayer rug. Our notion of Islam as forbidding imagery is not quite correct, says Haider. Yes, in the purely religious sphere, images are discouraged.
But they appear widely outside that context, especially when it comes to the illustration of books and poetry and literature.
The 15 rooms that comprise the renovated galleries, which now bear the unwieldy title, The Art of the Arab Lands, Turkey, Iran, Central Asia, and later South Asia, are arranged to highlight the diversity and interconnectedness of these different cultures, as well as their connection to cultures we might not think are connected, Roman, Chinese, European. The galleries show 13 centuries of works from different cultures, Spain to Turkey, Iran to India.
So you don't get the sense of a single monolith, but you get the sense of a very faceted world with many, many dimensions to it.
The confluence of these cultures is everywhere. For example, a little bowl from China, 12th or 13th century, with a fish at the base in a circular pattern. And next to it, a bowl from Iran with exactly the same pattern. But the most startling thing about the galleries is their beauty. For example, in the carpet room, filled with Ottoman Empire masterpieces, every carpet is individually lit, but everything else remains dark.
There's a sense of mystery, I guess I would say, in this room for the eye, because the eye can't quite tell where the light is coming from or what the logic of the light is, but it's there, and it adds to a kind of certain atmospheric effect, I think, in this room.
There are so many carpets here. We are immediately in a situation where sound has been muffled. There are a sizable number of people here, and yet it doesn't sound the way the rest of the exhibit sounds.
I think there's also something, the power of these objects, the colors, the patterns, and the fact that you are completely enveloped in this room in a world of stars, medallions, and interlocking forms, all in these beautiful, warm colors. It takes you instantly into a kind of another sphere.
There is something very meditative about this space. There's something compelling about the use of architecture here as well. There are wooden carved window screens that filter light into certain rooms and allow shadows to play on the floor. If the sun is not streaming in, you can look through the screen out into the Roman court below, allowing another sense of interconnection. Then there is the Moroccan courtyard with a little fountain and places to sit. There were even rose petals in the water the day I visited. The columns are Spanish from the 15th century, But the woodwork, the tiles, and the plaster carvings are all made by current artisans from Fez, Morocco.
The idea was to create this Islamic space to show the living traditions of the Islamic world and also to create an area where you don't have to look at anything, you don't have to read a label, you can sit on the bench, relax, look at the fountain.
And ruminate on what you've seen so far. Now, given how politicized Islam has become in the United States since 9/11, how did the huge team that put this installation together over nearly a decade engage with that political reality? Haider, who was raised in New Delhi by a Hindu mother and a Muslim father, says at first Met curators and planners lived only in the world of pure scholarship. But they also realized after a while that everyone would come to the museum with their own experiences of the world. Haider does hope people will be able to experience the beauty of each object for itself.
And hopefully sense that each of these objects has the power to take them way, way beyond their present moment. And the totality of them can take them absolutely to another place.
But she hopes they will also understand something deeper about cultures, interconnection, and complexity.
The same person who wakes up in the morning, reads the paper, has a certain idea about his world, can come in here and be offered a wider and deeper perspective. I think more than anything else, we have great faith in the collection itself. We believe in its power, and I personally feel that never has this collection had more power and meaning than now. And I have full confidence that anyone who comes with an open mind and open heart will take a lot back home with them that they didn't have when they first arrived.
But if there is one message, she says, it's that the heritage of the Islamic world is the heritage of everyone. Whether you approach it from Spain or Iran or Turkey or from India, however you find your way in, she says, welcome to the beautiful world of these objects. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
And you can see pictures of the Metropolitan Museum of Art's renovated Gallery of Islamic Art. It's called Art of the Arab Lands, Turkey, Iran, Central Asia, and later South Asia. You can find it all at npr.org.
Tonight, like most Saturday nights in college towns across the country, students are getting ready to party. And the one thing most of those parties will have in common, besides a few chilled kegs, is a large stack of cups, red plastic cups, to be precise. And just how did these big, bright liquid holders get so popular that folks are now singing about them? Producer Lauren Silverman volunteered to do some research.
That red cup is part of a legacy that stretches back 75 years. It's made by a company called Solo, from the folks that brought us those little paper cone cups at the water cooler and the wax-lined cups at fast food joints. But nothing has had the impact of the red Solo cup.
My first experience with the Solo cup, I'm guessing it was in high school at some kind of keg party we should not have been throwing.
That's Seth Stevenson. He's a reporter for Slate Magazine, an occasional beer drinker, and a major fan of country singer Toby Keith's new song.
Now, Red Solo Cup is the best receptacle for barbecues, tailgates, fairs, and festivals. And
okay, wait a second. I need to make it clear that Solo did not pay Toby Keith to write this song. Even scarier, he's just one of many who worship at the shrine of the Red Cup.
Actually, I've seen people use it as a to-go cup. One woman, I watched her make her scrambled eggs in the morning, and she put it in her cup, and she said, "This is how I go to work."
That's Kim Healy. She's vice president of Solo's consumer business department.
People make flowers out of these cups. We had someone that made a full lobster costume out of our cups, head to toe.
I love you, Red Solo Cup. I lift you up. Proceed to party.
When I joined the company and saw how iconic the red party cup was, my first inclination was, well, then we shouldn't change anything about it.
But that's exactly what Kim Healy did in 2009, and it caught Seth Stevenson's eye.
One day I was walking through the grocery store and I noticed a subtle change, and the Red Solo cup had square sides and a square bottom instead of the round one I was used to. And suddenly it occurred to me that the Red Solo cup has been this ever-present item in my life since I was a teenager, and it had changed. It looks like a tank.
The shape changed, Kim Healy says, because people wanted something sturdier that wouldn't slip out of your hand when beer sloshes over the side.
You're more than just plastic. You're more than amazing. You're more than fantastic.
Now, plenty of other companies make disposable plastic cups, and a lot of them are cheaper than Solo's. but this is the one that's become king of the keggers.
It's just become synonymous with partying, and when people go to the store to stock up for their barbecue, that Red Solo Cup, it calls to them.
And now, it sings.
Red Solo Cup, I fill you up, let's have a party.
Lauren Silverman, NPR News.
The story now about the F word. Actually, the other F word, which is the title of a new documentary film. And we should say here that the other F word is fatherhood. The subtitle of the film is The Coming of Middle Age, and it tells us how a handful of serious punk rock performers have made the transition from rebels to responsible family men. The movie is funny and serious and obscene and sweet, and its director and writer is Andrea Blaugrund-Nevins, who joins us now from our studios in Culver City, California. Welcome, Andrea. Welcome back, Andrea, I should say.
Oh, thank you, Robert.
I should explain that 25 years ago, you were booking interviews for All Things Considered.
That's right.
I guess about 25 years ago, the guys who made this film bet were young and living like there was no tomorrow.
They sure were.
How did this idea to find punk musicians who've turned into devoted fathers, how did this come about?
A dear friend of mine, Kristen Riley, who is now the producer of the film, came to me with a book written by an old high school chum of hers named Jim Lindbergh. And the book he had written was called Punk Rock Dad. And it was what seemed like a really fun oxymoron to jump into. And we did. We went down the punk rock rabbit hole and came out with this movie.
Jim Lindbergh, I say this as if I knew this before 72 hours ago. Jim Lindbergh is from the band Pennywise. Here's a clip of him as he's packing for a long tour.
I've been doing this for 20 years, being a singer for a punk band.
Rock Belt, that's where the magic happens.
Can we get you a different pair?
We have a big album coming out. You know, a lot of touring in front of us.
You got open house at school. I'll be in Myrtle Beach.
Sometimes I'll be here. Sometimes I'll be gone.
No, I can't take 20 Barbies. I'll take one.
He's the person we see most of in this film, and he seems to have made the transition pretty well from wild and crazy young guy to daddy.
He's made it pretty well, but it's been a struggle. It's really hard to go out and yell the band's anthem, F Authority, and then come home and be the ultimate authority in his house.
Yes, we're talking about not just the language of the performance, the look of the performance, the tattoos that go along with being a punk rock musician, the attitude towards society. It's a pretty sharp turn one has to make to start socializing one's children.
It is, but what I discovered in doing this film, and didn't expect at all, I was really just thinking of it more as a potential comedy. What I discovered was that a lot of these guys were really devastated by their own fathers. And when handed a child, suddenly that all came rushing to the forefront, and they felt like they had to truly be there in a way that their parents weren't. And in many ways, that was the reason for the strength of their early rebellion.
Yeah, I have to say that I had actually assumed that a lot of the outrage of punk bands was as much a pose as a statement of what their lives were like. And in fact, you interview a lot of people here who really had horrible upbringings and came from terribly broken families and backgrounds.
They did. And more than that, I think that all of them were, in addition to having been maltreated as children, they were also very sensitive kids and really kind of the poets of their classes. And so they felt that they needed to express the outrage that they were experiencing and in a poetic way, but not your regular sonnet.
Yeah, here's one of my favorite moments of balance in the film. This is it Tim McElrath?
Tim McElrath, yes, indeed.
McElrath,
Rise Against.
The band Rise Against. We hear him playing his song on guitar with his little grade school age daughter, and then it segues to him performing that very song in concert.
You know how it goes? I'll start it.
Now I'm standing on a
rooftop, ready to fly.
I think I'm at the
age now,
but I could be
wrong.
Now I'm standing on the...
That's all I know.
That's all you know?
I'm standing on a rooftop. I think I'm at the edge. Not the typical song that father and daughter sing together.
No, not at all. But these kids are being raised with some real truths in their lives, and I think it's benefiting all of them.
One tension here is between the aging punk rock musician and his family, but the other tension is between the musician and his fans. For his family, he may have to become a mature daddy, but for the fans, he has to remain the raucous kid out there.
Absolutely. It was one of the things that really struck me in doing the research for this, because I was not a punk rock fan growing up. And what struck me was that with most musical genres, the audience ages with the artist. But in this case, this is really an art form that speaks almost exclusively to rebellious, angry teenagers. And as you're getting older, it becomes kind of ironic to be up there screaming a teenage kind of angst. And a lot of these guys are struggling with how do you stay honest? Because honesty and authenticity is sort of the watchwords of the punk movement.
Yes, there's one of the musicians remarks, there's a bit of the clown playing the kid's birthday party here. Old guys coming in dressed up and making youngsters, teenagers, happy in their anger.
And so when do you call it quits if it's actually still putting bread on the table? And then what do you do if that is your expertise? It's a question they were all asking themselves.
These are bands that somebody says in the documentary that they're not so big that they could do a couple of shows a year and live through their 50s on that income. They've got to get out there. They've got to get out and perform, which means being away from little children.
Exactly. And their coming of age and really having to put food on the table corresponded with the decline of the music industry. So that's one of the things that all of them are dealing with, the fact that they used to be able to put out a record and at least be able to feed the kids off of that. But now with file sharing and the decline in CD sales, they have to get out there to get paid. They have to get ticket sales to get paid.
I won't spoil the end of the film here, but Jim Lindbergh, throughout the movie, has to make a big decision. He reflects on that in a very honest, revealing way about what he's learned. So I wonder what you've learned from making this film about him and the others.
You know, it was something that I was wrestling with, this decision about how much do you work and how much do you try and spend time with your kids. It's such a tremendous pull, I think, on all of us who have children. And I think what I learned is that I have to be there as much as I possibly can.
Of course, this story, one can see it as an extreme, that is, people mm-hmm. who in their youth, which went deep into their 40s, let's say, were out performing raucously, publicly misbehaving, and the question is, how do they reconcile that with raising their children? But in a much broader and perhaps less shocking sense, parents have done things in their youth. They've behaved in ways that were young and irresponsible, and it's a general question. How do you reconcile that with the kids you're raising? Knowing some things are inevitable, some bad choices are inevitable, but hoping they won't make too many of them.
Exactly. And I think all of us go through a period where we have to reevaluate who we are in the world. We're no longer the person who's rebelling against our parents. And one of the reasons why I wanted to explore this with punk rockers is because I think it's actually much harder for them because their whole identity is involved in being the rebel. And then how do you come home and send your kids to school and make sure they get their homework done? And, you know, I think a lot of these guys are finding it amusing that they have to play the deleted F-word version of their songs in the car for their kids. Otherwise, their kids can't share their art. I think that's very hard.
Well, Andrea, thank you for talking with us about the film.
Thank you for taking the time. Oh. I so appreciate it.
That's Andrea Blaugren-Nevins, who is writer and director of the documentary film The Other F-Word. It opens today in New York and on Friday in Los Angeles.
The biggest selling pop artist of the year has gone silent. The British pop soul singer Adele was forced to cancel the rest of her 2011 tour. Earlier this year, she suffered two vocal hemorrhages and will need to undergo surgery. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, many famous singers have needed similar treatment.
Take a listen to some of the great vocal cords that have gone under the knife.
Do, a deer, a female deer.
Blue jean baby. L.A. lady.
Less like murder, she rolled. Once I get you out them clothes.
We keep on waiting, waiting on the world to change.
John Mayer had his surgery in the last few weeks. Singers are in a high-risk business. Dr. Steven Zeitels is director of the Voice Center at Massachusetts General Hospital.
Essentially, people who sing are vocal athletes. So you can look at this as a
not unusual scenario in someone who's an athlete getting an injury in that area.
Dr. Zeitels is now working with Adele. The list of his patients is like a who's who of great singers. Julie Andrews, Roger Daltrey, and opera singer Denise Graves. Denise Graves says in 2000, her vocal cords hemorrhaged while she was backstage in the middle of an engagement.
I sneezed. It was that simple. I sneezed and I hemorrhaged.
Graves says it was clear something serious had happened.
I lost my voice immediately. And it was one of the most frightening and terrifying experiences ever.
She had surgery, but says she kept it a secret for fear the news would hurt her career. The causes of vocal injuries aren't always the same, but unlike athletes or even other musicians, what singers all share is the fact that their voice, their instrument, is being used constantly.
What people don't seem to understand is the voice, the vocal cords, are incredibly fragile.
Roger Love is a voice coach who's worked with a number of celebrities, Maroon 5, John Mayer, and Gwen Stefani, among others. He says when they're working, they put their voices through a tremendous amount of wear and tear.
They're traveling, maybe they didn't sleep well, they're out of their own element. Then they have radio interviews, press interviews, then they head to sound check. Then they've got to make it through the rest of the afternoon into the evening, talking to all the technical people, talking to the managers, more using the voice.
And then, after all that, there's the show.
There's a fire starting in my heart, reaching a fever pitch and it's bringing me out the dark.
After surgery, Adele will most likely need a number of months to recover, says Dr. Steven Zeitels. Denise Graves credits him with practically saving her career, but she says she and other singers still have to watch what they do all the time. She remembers one early morning voice class she had when she was in college.
And my voice teacher said, "Your voice doesn't sound the same as it did, you know, a couple days ago. What were you doing last night?" And I said, "Oh, I was out with friends and we were laughing." And she said, "You were laughing on the night before a voice lesson?" And I thought, yikes, what have I gotten myself into?
Adele is learning the hard way. This has been her breakout year. And she wrote on her blog that she's heartbroken and frustrated she can't perform. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
A couple of years ago, the rapper J. Cole was working for $10 an hour as a bill collector. Today, he has one of the biggest hit records on the Billboard charts. It's called The Sideline Story.
So I try to show her about the world and about just who we really are. And where we've come and how we still have to go really far. Like, baby, look at how we live broke on the boulevard.
J. Cole's story is somewhat unusual in the world of rap. For starters, he was born in Germany. Both his parents were in the military. And he didn't grow up in a big city, but rather in Fayetteville, North Carolina. He also graduated from college, St. John's University in New York, and magna cum laude. No less. In 2009, J. Cole was discovered by hip-hop mogul Jay-Z. It's taken him 3 years to complete this debut album, and it's been attracting critical acclaim, not just for the rhymes, but for the stories J. Cole tells as well. He came into our New York studios.
How you doing, brother?
I'm great. It's great to have you.
Man, thank you for having me.
I have heard you describe yourself as a storyteller. What are the stories you're telling on this record?
My own, first and foremost, just this journey of being this kid who had this dream to be this rapper for such a long time, and then the obstacles that I had to go through just to get signed and put out an album. But other than that, I'm telling a lot of life stories, things that I feel like people my age go through. And there's a song on the album that deals with abortion where I like kind of tackle young pregnancy, basically.
Frankly, I'm feeling like we ain't ready in this. Hold up now, let me finish. Think about it, baby. Me and you, we still kids ourselves. How we gonna raise a kid by ourselves?
I love to tell stories. I didn't start off as a storyteller. I started off as a battle rapper, but I just really drifted towards storytelling for some reason.
Tell me about your upbringing in Fayetteville, North Carolina.
Man, I feel like it was the best, at least for my line of work, it was the best upbringing I could have had. I started off on a military base, and I remember moving. I guess this is after my parents got divorced, but I remember moving from there straight to a trailer park. And it was like one of the scariest places I've been to because I was always worried about my mother. I grew up with, you know, a white mother, and we're in this all-black neighborhood, trailer park. And around the fifth or sixth grade, I moved from there into a nicer house where I had my own room. You know, so I saw life at all levels. So I'm half black, half white. So I basically put it like this. I could fit in anywhere. That's why I write so many stories from so many different perspectives, because I've seen so many.
You did, and you can move in and out of different worlds. I mean, you talk about your mom on the one hand driving you around Fayetteville with public radio on in the car, yeah. And on the other hand, you could hang out with all kinds of kids and from different walks of life.
My mom is probably listening as we speak, and this is not just because I'm on here. Like, she really listens to NPR. What's up, Mama?
Your father left the family when you were very young, and you sing about that in the song Breakdown.
Yeah, look, I just shed tears, homie. Now I ain't too proud to admit it. To see my father for the first time in a minute. And when I say a minute, I mean years, man. Damn, well, could have swam in them tears, fam.
You described seeing your dad as a kid, and presumably you didn't see him often. And you have a line in that song, a whale could have swam in them tears. That's pretty intense stuff.
Yeah, I appreciate that. What I was trying to say in that song is that I didn't grow up in the same city as my father, in the same place. So I graduated school, and he came to my graduation because he is that type of father. But it was around the time of my life I started to just analyze and be like, man, it just felt so good to see my pops. Man, I wish that, you know, it was one of those breakdown moments.
But I want a father so bad I can't help but break down. I break down.
And that's another thing rappers don't really talk about. They don't really discuss, like, you're married, you better not cry. So that's why I kind of get excited to tell the world, like, yo, I just shed tears. Like, if you hear me, I'm almost proud of it.
I'm speaking with the hip-hop artist J. Cole. His debut album is called Cole World, The Sideline Story. And you graduated from St. John's University in New York, magna cum laude.
Yes, sir.
I'm not sure if that was a help or a hindrance in the line of work you chose.
I think it's been a help, man. Mm-hmm. I just try to spin it into a positive because it is one.
But you were a serious student.
I was. I'm a competitor. My mom tells this story of, like, when I was in the second grade or first grade, and I would be at the teacher's desk every day asking her, like, can I get my average? And the teacher would be like, man, you're in first grade. Why you want your average? But it was a competition for me. Like, I really, you know, I want to be the best. Anything I do, I want to do it well.
Got a dollar and a train, solid gas. So if it's about that cream, then I'm all up in the spot. I got a dollar and a train. Just a dollar and a train.
You're clearly driven. I mean, there's a story about how you tried to break into hip-hop. You actually recorded beats for Jay-Z. You were hoping to hand him a CD. This is back, I think, in 2007. You waited outside his studio for 2 hours. He finally pulls up in his fancy car. What happened?
Jay-Z, he's on the phone. Like, he got an earpiece in his ear. He walks up to the door. I have a CD out. I took my time with this thing. I kind of decorated it. I put it in one of his old albums, trying to be creative. and I reach out my hand like, yo, Jay, here you go. He just looked at me like, almost disgusted, like, man, I don't want that. You know, I was crushed, but I realized really quick, like, yo, this is not how you're gonna get on. You gotta get on through the music. Like, and sure enough, a year later, he was asking to meet me because he had heard.
You were just recording on your own and releasing music on your own.
Absolutely. I was recording in New York City, sneaking in the studios. And, you know, it was getting out there. People in the industry started to kind of hear about me.
J. Cole, I want to talk about how you bend words, how you make them rhyme.
Cobain, dope flames, Liu Kang, the coach ain't help out. So I call my own shots. I'm David Blaine. I'm breaking out of my own box. You stay the same. But homie, if you change, may you change for the better. Back when Martin King had a thing for Coretta.
You rhyme throw flames, Liu Kang. When Martin King had a thing for Coretta, rhymes with better.
Yeah.
Talk to me about how you think about rhymes and structure.
Man, those words to me are nothing. Those flows and those patterns, those rhyme patterns are nothing without meanings to the words. So the fact that I was doing that and telling you a story at the same time was incredible. A lot of rappers can do those flows, but the raps aren't really about anything, which is cool sometimes, but to have the flow and the message is one of my favorite things.
J. Cole, I want to ask you about the state of rap. One of your heroes is Nas. He's, he's quite possibly one of the five or six greatest rappers of all time.
Absolutely, hands down.
And he famously, of course, put out a record called Hip Hop is Dead.
She's dead, she's dead.
And in your song, Rise and Shine, you say, rap's very much alive.
Yeah, this is one of the greatest rappers ever telling you hip-hop is dead. But it was that hunger of the people to want something better that allowed an artist like myself to even come out and have a number one album. It's because when people finally hear it, it's like, ah, yeah, this is what it's supposed to feel like. And by the way, there's a 12-year-old right now whose favorite rapper is J. Cole. And because I'm representing the true essence of what this thing should be about, this hip-hop thing, and I'm his favorite rapper, and he decides tomorrow he wants to write rhymes, he's going to emulate me, which means that the future of hip-hop is kind of secure, you know, if we continue in this pattern.
In a game full of liars, it turns out that I'm the truth. Some say that rap's alive, it turns out that I'm the proof. Because the ones y'all thought would save the day can't even tie my boots. The ones y'all thought can hang with me can't even tie my noose. Let these words be my bullets. God, I don't rhyme, I shoot. Bang.
That's hip-hop artist J. Cole. His debut album is called Cole World, A Sideline Story. It debuted at number one on the Billboard 200. J. Cole, thank you so much.
Man, thank you for having me. What an honor.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all of the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Sammy Yenigan. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.